They allow us back to the other place on a temporary basis, to repair our essence and renew our strength. No master in his right mind would permit a jinni to deteriorate as far as I had done. No master in his right mind. Well, that, of course, was the problem. I was interrupted in my gloomy cogitation by a stirring in mid-air. The girl looked up. Above the road appeared the faintest shimmering, a delicate tingling of pretty pink and yellow lights. It was invisible on the first plane, and thus went unnoticed by the people trudging up the street, but if any children had seen it, they'd probably have guessed it to be fairy dust, which shows how wrong you can be. With an abrupt scratching noise, the lights froze, and were drawn back from the middle like two curtains. Between them appeared the grinning face of a bald baby with bad acne. Its evil little eyes were red and sore, indicating an owner who kept long hours and bad habits. For a few moments they peered myopically to and fro. The baby swore under its breath and rubbed its eyes with dirty little fists. All at once it noticed my concealment and let out a dreadful oath. Probably Germanic in origin. It involved nailing someone's entrails to an oak tree. I regarded it with cool impassivity.
"Oi, Bart!" the baby cried. "That you in there? Stir yourself! You're wanted!"
I spoke casually. "By whom?"
"You know full well. And boy, are you in trouble! I reckon it's the shriveling fire for sure this time."
"Is that so?" The girl remained firmly seated on the broken chimney and crossed her slender arms. "Well, if Mandrake wants me, he can come and get me himself." The baby grinned nastily.
"Good. I was hoping you'd say that. No problem, Barty. I'll pass that on. Can't wait to see what he'll do."
The imp's malicious glee irritated me. We were, after all, slaves together. We had both suffered long at Mandrake's hands. A bit of empathy would not, I think, have been out of place. But the imp's long confinement had rather soured its world view, which has happened to far better spirits than it over the years. If I'd had a little more energy, I'd have leapt up and swallowed it there and then. I contented myself with snapping off a chimney pot and throwing it with unerring aim. It struck the baby's bald, fat head with a satisfactory ringing sound. "As I thought," I said. "Hollow." The unlovely grin converted into a scowl.
"You cad! Just you wait. We'll see who's laughing when I watch you burn."
Propelled by a gust of ripe language, it popped back behind its curtains of glimmering lights and drew them smartly together. Twinkling softly, the lights dissipated on the breeze. The imp was gone. The girl pushed a strand of hair behind one ear, refolded her arms grimly, and settled back to wait. Now there would be consequences, which was exactly what I needed. It was time for a proper confrontation. To begin with, years before, my master and I had got along well enough. I don't mean amicably or anything ridiculous like that, but our mutual irritation was founded on something approximating respect. During a series of early incidents, from the Loveless conspiracy to the Golem affair, I had been forced to acknowledge Mandrake's verve and daring, his energy, and even, faintly, the glimmerings of his conscience. It wasn't much, admittedly, but it made his prissiness, stubbornness, pride and ambition a little less hard to stomach. In return, I obviously had no shortage of wonderful traits for him to admire, and anyway, he could barely get up in the morning without needing me to save his sorry skin. We coexisted in a wary state of toleration. For a year or so after the defeat of the Golem and Mandrake's promotion to head of internal affairs, he didn't push me around too much. He summoned me from time to time to help out with minor incidents, which I haven't got time to go into here, but generally speaking he left me pretty much alone. If memory serves, these included the case of the Afrit, the envelope, and the ambassador's wife, the affair of the curiously heavy trunk, and the messy episode of the anarchist and the oyster. Mandrake nearly lost his life in all of those. As I say, none of them was of much interest. On the odd occasion that he did call me, we both knew where he stood. We had an agreement of sorts. I knew his birth name, and he knew I knew it. Though he threatened me with dire consequences if I told anyone, in practice he treated me with careful detachment in all our dealings. I kept his name to myself, and he kept me away from the most dangerous tasks, which basically boiled down to the fighting in America. Dozens of Jin were dying there. The reverberations of the losses rang harshly through the other place, and I was happy to have no part in it. To those of us abreast with human history, the cause of the latest war was drearily familiar. For years the Americans had refused to pay the taxes demanded of them by London. The British swiftly fell back on the oldest argument of all, and sent over an army to beat the colonists up. After initial easy victories, stagnation set in. The rebels retreated into thick woods, sending Jin out to ambush the advancing troops. Several prominent British magicians were killed. The 6th and 7th fleets were summoned from the China Seas to bolster the campaign, but still the fighting dribbled on. Months went by. The Empire's strength was frittered away in the American wastes, and the repercussions resounded around the globe. Time passed. Mandrake worked at his job with his usual zeal. An opportunity for promotion came, and he accepted it. He was now Information Minister, one of the great ones of the Empire. His chance came, thanks to the war. The rebel guerrillas were causing the British Army problems. After a year of attritional fighting, the foreign minister, a certain Mr. Fry, visited the colonists secretly with a view to arranging a truce. 8 magicians watched him as he travelled. A host of haulers guarded his every step. The minister was invulnerable, or so they thought. On his first night in Philadelphia, he was treacherously slain by an imp concealed in his evening pie. Amid general outrage, the Prime Minister reshuffled his ministers, and Mandrake joined the ruling council. Officially, his duties were to do with propaganda, devising clever ways of selling the war to the British people. Unofficially, at the Prime Minister's behest, he continued much of his internal affairs police work, operating an unsavoury network of surveillance djinn and human spies, which reported directly to him. His workload, which had always been severe, now became crippling. There followed a dismal sea change in my master's personality. Never exactly famous for his light-hearted banter, he became positively abrupt and antisocial, even less willing than before to shoot the breeze with a debonair djinnie. But by cruel paradox, he also began to summon me more and more frequently, and for less and less reason. Why did he do so? Mainly, no doubt, because he wished to minimize the chances of my being summoned by another magician. His old fear, now fueled by chronic fatigue and paranoia, was that I would divulge his birth name to an enemy, rendering him vulnerable to attack. Well, fair enough. That was always possible. I might have done it. Can't say for sure. But he'd managed without me in the past, and nothing had happened to him. So I thought something else was going on, too. Mandrake masked his emotions well enough, but his whole life was work, remorseless and never-ending. Moreover, he was now surrounded by a gang of vicious, hot-eyed maniacs, the other ministers, most of whom wished him harm. His only close associate, for a time, was the hack playwright Quentin Makepeace, as self-serving as all the rest. To survive in this friendless world, Mandrake cloaked his better qualities under layers of smarm and swank. All his old life, the years with the Underwoods, his vulnerable existence as the boy Nathaniel, the ideals he'd once espoused, was buried away deep down. Every link with his childhood was severed, except for me. I don't think he could bring himself to break this last connection. I proposed this theory in my usual gentle way, but Mandrake was unwilling to listen to my taunts. He was a worried man. I'm stretching the term a bit here, I know. By now, in his mid to late teens, he might just about have passed for a man, when seen from behind, at a distance, on a very dark night. The American campaigns were vastly expensive. The British supply lines overstretched. With the magician's attention diverted, other parts of the Empire had become troublesome. Foreign spies infested London like maggots in an apple. The commoners were volatile. To counter all this, Mandrake worked like a slave. Well, not literally like a slave. That was my job. And a pretty thankless one it was, too. Back at Internal Affairs, some of the assignments had been almost worthy of my talents. I'd intercepted enemy messages and deciphered them, given out false reports, trailed enemy spirits, duffed a few of them up, etc. It was simple, satisfying work. I got a craftsman's pleasure from it. In addition, I helped Mandrake and the police in the search for two fugitives from the Golem affair. The first of these was a certain mysterious mercenary. Distinguishing features, big beard, grim expression, swanky black clothes, general invulnerability to infernos, detonations, pretty much everything else. He'd last been seen far away in Prague, and predictably enough we never got a whiff of him. The second was an even more nebulous character, whom no one had even set eyes on. He apparently went by the name of Hopkins, and claimed to be a scholar. He was generally suspected of masterminding the Golem plot, and I'd heard he'd been involved with the Resistance, too. But he might as well have been a ghost or shadow, for all the substance we could pin down. We found a spidery signature in an admissions book at an old library that might have been his. That was all. The trail, such as it was, went cold. Then Mandrake became Information Minister, and I was soon engaged in more depressing work, viz. Pasting up adverts on 1,000 billboards across London, distributing pamphlets to 25,000 homes across ditto, corralling selected animals for public holiday entertainments. Following the Roman tradition, the magician sought to keep the people docile with regular holidays, in which free shows were put on in all the major parks. Lots of exotic beasts from across the empire were displayed, as were minor imps and sprites allegedly caught during the war. Human prisoners were paraded along the streets, or enclosed in special glass viewing globes in the St. James's Park pavilions for the populace to jeer at. Supervising food, drink, and hygiene for same, flying back and forth across the capital for hours on end, trailing pro-war banners. Now, call me picky, but I'd argue that when you think of a 5,000-year-old jinni, the scourge of civilizations and confidant of kings, certain things come to mind. Swashbuckling espionage, perhaps, or valiant battles, thrilling escapes, and general multipurpose excitement. What you don't readily think of is that same noble jinni being forced to prepare giant vats of chili con carne for festival days, or struggling on street corners with bill posters and pots of glue. Especially without being allowed to return home. Soon my periods of respite in the other place became so fleeting I practically got whiplash travelling there and back. Then one day Mandrake ceased dismissing me altogether. And that was it. I was trapped on Earth. Over the next 2 years I grew steadily weaker, and just when I was hitting rock bottom, scarcely able to lift a poster brush, the wretched boy began sending me out on more dangerous missions again, fighting bands of enemy djinn that Britain's many enemies were using to stir up trouble. In the past, I'd have had a quiet word with Mandrake, expressing my disapproval with succinct directness. But my privileged access to him was no more. He'd taken to summoning me along with a host of other slaves, giving orders en masse and sending us off like a pack of dogs. Such multiple summoning is a difficult business, requiring great mental strength on the part of the magician, but Mandrake did it daily without apparent effort, talking quietly with his assistant, or even flicking through a newspaper while we stood and sweated in our circles. I did my best to get to him. Instead of using a monstrous guise like my fellow slaves, Ascobol's Cyclops and Cormacodron's boar-headed behemoth were typical, I took to wearing the semblance of Kitty Jones, the resistance girl Mandrake had persecuted years before. Her assumed death still weighed on his conscience. I knew this because he always reacted to my echo of her face with a reddening of his own. He'd get all angry and sheepish, assertive and embarrassed at the same time. Didn't make him treat me any better, mind. Well, I'd had about as much as I could stand from Mandrake. It was time to have it out with him. By refusing to go back with the imp, I obliged the magician to recall me officially, which would doubtless hurt, but was at least likely to mean he gave me the benefit of his attention for 5 minutes. The imp had been gone for hours. In the past, I'd have got a swift response from my master, but the delay was typical of his new distractedness. I smoothed back Kitty Jones's long, dark hair and cast my eye around the little rural town. Several commoners had gathered around the ruined post office and were engaged in passionate debate. They resisted the efforts of a lone policeman to make them return to their homes. No doubt about it, the people were growing restless. Which turned my thoughts to Kitty once again. Despite appearances to the contrary, she hadn't died in battle with the golem 3 years before. Instead, after acting with unusual selflessness and bravery to save Mandrake's worthless hide, she'd slipped quietly away. Our encounter had been brief but stimulating. Her passionate opposition to injustice reminded me of someone else I'd known a long time ago. Part of me hoped Kitty had bought a one-way ticket to somewhere safe and distant and had set up a cafe on a beach or something out of harm's way. But deep down, I knew she was still close by, working against the magicians. That knowledge rather pleased me, though she'd had no love for gin. Whatever she was doing, I hoped she was keeping out of trouble. Chapter 4 Kitty. The demon saw Kitty the moment she moved. A wide mouth opened in the stubby, featureless head. Double rows of teeth descended from above and rose from the lining of the jaw. It snipped its teeth together curiously, making a noise like a thousand scissors, slicing in unison. Folds of grey-green flesh shifted on either side of the skull, revealing two golden eyes that glinted as they turned on her. Kitty did not repeat her mistake. She stood stock still, barely 6 feet from the bent and snuffling head, and held her breath. The demon scraped a foot experimentally against the floor, scoring 5 thick claw gashes in the tiles. It made a curious crooning noise deep in its throat. It was sizing her up, she knew it was, appraising her strength, debating whether to attack. In the final moments of crisis, her brain took in many irrelevant details of its guise. The flecks of grey hair about the joints, the bright metal scales upon the torso, the hands with too many fingers and too few bones. Her own limbs shook, her hands twitched as if to encourage her to run, but she fought against her fear and beat it down. Then a voice came, sweet and female, curiously inquiring. "Aren't you going to run, my dear? I can only lope along on these club feet. Ah, me, so slow. Try it. You never know. You might escape." So gentle was the voice, it took Kitty a moment to realize it came from the dreadful mouth. It was the demon that spoke. Numbly she shook her head. The demon flexed 6 fingers in an incomprehensible gesture. "Then at least step toward me," the sweet voice said. "It would save me the torture of hobbling over to you on these poor club feet of mine. Ah, me, so sore! My essence flinches from the pull of your harsh, cruel earth." Again Kitty shook her head, slower this time. The demon sighed, bowing its head as if crushed and disappointed. "My dear, you have no courtesy. I wonder whether your essence would disagree with me if I ate you. I am a martyr to indigestion." The head rose, the eyes sparkled, the teeth snipped like a thousand scissors. "I will risk it." Without pause, the leg joints bent and sprang, the jaws opened, wide, 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 the fingers clasped. Kitty fell back, screamed. A wall of silver shards, thin as rapiers, rose from the floor, spearing the demon as it leapt. A flash, a shower of sparks, its body burst into lilac flames. It hovered in mid-air for a split second, twitched, emitted a single gout of smoke, then drifted softly to the floor, light as burning paper. A little voice whispered, sad, resentful. "Ah, me!" Now it was nothing but a husk, which fell in upon itself and presently dwindled into ashes. Kitty's muscles were frozen in a rictus of terror. With a grim effort she managed to close her mouth and blink, once, twice. She ran a trembling hand through her hair.
"Great heavens!" her master said from the pentacle on the opposite side of the room. "I didn't expect that. But the stupidity of these creatures is boundless. Sweep away the mess, dear Lizzie, and we can discuss the procedure. You must be very proud of your success."
Dumbly, eyes still staring, Kitty managed the faintest of nods. She stepped stiff-legged from the circle and went to fetch the broom.
"Well, you're a clever girl and no mistake."
Her master was sitting on the sofa nearest the window, sipping from a china cup.
"And you make good tea, too, which is a blessing on a day like this one."
Rain battered the window panes and gusted haphazardly across the street. The wind whined in the passages of the house. Kitty drew her feet up out of the draught, skirling across the floor, and took a swig of strong brown tea from her mug. The old man wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"Yes, a very satisfactory summons. Not bad at all. And most interesting for me, who'd have thought the true form of a succubus looked like that? Gracious! Now, Lizzie, did you notice that you slightly mispronounced the restraining syllable right at the end? Not enough to break the safety wall, but the creature was emboldened, thought it would try its luck. Fortunately, everything else you did was perfect."
Kitty was still shaking. She sank back among the cushions of the ancient sofa.
"If I'd made any other mistake, sir," she said haltingly, "what would have—"
"Oh, gracious! I wouldn't worry your head about that. You didn't, and that's what counts. Have a chocolate digestive."
He indicated the plate between them.
"Settles the stomach, I find."
She took a biscuit, dunked it in her tea.
"But why did it attack me?" she said, frowning. "Surely it must have been able to tell that the Pentacle's defences would come into force."
Her master chuckled.
"Who can say? Perhaps it hoped you would flinch out of the circle as it leapt. That would have instantly destroyed its prison and allowed it to devour you. Notice that it had already tried two childish stratagems to persuade you to leave the Pentacle. It was not a sophisticated jinni. But perhaps it had grown tired of bondage. Perhaps it simply wished to die."
He eyed the dregs at the bottom of his teacup, musingly.
"Who can tell? We understand so little about demons, about what makes them tick. They are hard to fathom. Is there any more in the pot?"
Kitty inspected it.
"Nope. I'll make some more."
"If you would, dear Lizzie, if you would, you might pass me that copy of Trismegistus on your way out. He has some interesting notes on succubi, if I recall."
Chill air bit into her as she entered the passage and stomped down to the kitchen. There, leaning close to the blue gas flame hissing beneath the kettle, her self-control finally slackened. She began to tremble. Proper, heavy, body-shuddering shakes that made her grasp the work surface for support. She closed her eyes. The demon's open jaws plummeted toward her. She opened them again at speed. A paper bag of fruit sat beside the sink. Mechanically, she took an apple and ate it, gulping it down desperately in great rough chunks. She took another and finished it more slowly, staring sightlessly at the wall. Her trembling subsided. The kettle whistled. Jacob was right, she thought, rinsing her mug under an icy stream of water. I'm an idiot. Nobody but a fool would do this. Nobody but a fool. But a fool could still be lucky. And so far, for 3 long years, her luck had held. Since the day when her death had been reported and accepted, and the authorities had sealed their file on her with a blob of hot black wax, Kitty had never once left London. No matter that her good friend Jacob Herneck, safe with relatives in Bruges and working as a jeweller, sent her imploring epistles weekly, begging her to come and live with him. No matter that his family urged her, during their secretive, irregular meetings, to leave the dangers of the city and start her life afresh. No matter that her common sense cried out to her that she could do nothing useful on her own. Kitty was undeterred. In London she remained. Stubborn she still might be, but her old recklessness was now swathed with caution. Everything from her appearance to her daily routine was carefully judged to avoid arousing the suspicions of the authorities. This was essential, since for Kitty Jones, existence was itself a crime. To conceal herself from the eyes of those few who knew her, she had cropped her dark hair short and wore it in a bob beneath her cap. She kept tight rein on her mobile features, no matter what the provocation. She did her best to be dull-eyed, stone-faced, nothing but a numeral in a crowd. Though perhaps a little thinner in the face from overwork and lack of inessential food, though perhaps a little lined around the eyes, she still possessed the same mercurial energies that had borne her into the resistance and out again, alive. They supported her in pursuit of a certain ambitious project, and in the maintenance of no fewer than two false identities. She had taken lodgings on the third floor of a dilapidated West London townhouse in a street near the munitions factories. Up and below her bedsit were several other rooms that had been crammed by the enterprising landlord into the shell of the old building. Each was occupied, but save for the caretaker, a diminutive man who lived in the basement, Kitty had not spoken to any of the tenants. She passed them on the stairs sometimes, men and women, old and young, all living lives of isolation and anonymity. She was satisfied with this. She both liked and needed the solitude the house afforded her. The contents of her room were few. A small white cooker, a fridge, a cupboard, and in a corner, behind a dangling sheet, a sink and toilet. Below the window, which looked out over a tangle of walls and unkempt yards to the house backs opposite, sat a confusion of jumbled sheets and pillows. Kitty's bed. Beside this were neatly stacked her worldly possessions. Clothes, tins of food, newspapers, recent pamphlets about the war. Her most precious items were variously hidden beneath the mattress. A silver throwing disc wrapped in a handkerchief. In the cistern of her toilet, a sealed plastic bag containing the documents she needed to maintain her new identities, and at the bottom of her laundry bag, several thick books bound in leather. Being of practical disposition, Kitty did not regard her room with great affection. It was a place to sleep, and little more. She did not spend much time in it. Nevertheless, it was her home, and she had lived there for 3 years. The name she had given the landlord was Clara Bell. This coincided with the documents that she carried around with her most often, the stamped identity card and the residence, health, and education papers that mapped out her recent past. They had been forged for her with great skill by old Mr. Herneck, Jacob's father, who had also created a separate set for her under the name of Lizzie Temple. She did not have any papers with her real name. Only at night, when she lay back in the bed, with curtain drawn and the single light switched off, did she become Kitty Jones once more. It was an identity swathed in darkness and dreams. For some months following Jacob's departure, Clara Bell had worked at the Herneck's printing factory, delivering newly bound books and earning a basic wage. This did not last long. Kitty was reluctant to imperil her friends by too close an association, and had quickly taken on an evening job at a pub beside the river. By then, however, her humdrum errands had provided her with a most unusual opportunity. One morning, Kitty had been summoned to Mr. Herneck's office and handed a package to deliver. It was heavy, smelled of glue and leather, and was methodically wrapped in string. It was labelled, Mr. H. Button, Magician. Kitty inspected the address. Earl's Court, she said. Not many magicians there. Mr. Herneck was attending to his pipe with a blackened penknife and piece of cloth. "Among our beloved rulers," he said, flicking out a fragment of burnt soot, "this Button is regarded as an incurable eccentric. He's skilled enough, by all accounts, but has never attempted to rise through the political ranks.
Used to work as a librarian at the London Library until he had an accident. Lost a leg. Now just reads, collects books where he can, writes a bit. Told me once that he was interested in knowledge for its own sake, hence no money, hence Earl's Court. Take it along, will you?
Kitty had done so, and found Mr. Button's house in a region of grey-white villas, tall and heavy, with immense pillars supporting ostentatious porches above the doors. Once they had been occupied by the rich. Now the district carried a melancholy aura of poverty and decay. Mr. Button lived at the end of a tree-lined cul-de-sac, in a house shrouded by dark laurels. Kitty had rung the bell and waited on a stained and dirty step. No one answered. She noticed then that the door was hanging ajar. She peered inside. A dilapidated hall, made narrow by stacks of books against the walls. She coughed uncertainly.
"Hello?"
"Yes, yes, come in," a muffled voice echoed faintly. "But speed, if you will. I am a little inconvenienced."
Kitty hastened forward, and in a neighbouring room, rendered indistinct by dust-caked curtains drawn across the windows, discovered a twitching boot protruding from beneath a colossal pile of fallen books. Exploring further, she came upon the head and neck of an elderly gentleman, vainly struggling to wriggle free. Without preamble, Kitty made a rapid excavation. In a few minutes Mr. Button was settled in a nearby chair, a little crumpled and very out of breath.
"Thank you, my dear. Would you mind passing me my stick? I was using it to extract a book, which I fear caused all the trouble."
Kitty rescued a long ash stick from among the debris and handed it to the magician. He was a small and fragile man, bright-eyed, thin-faced, with a disordered mop of straight grey hair hanging low over his forehead. He wore a checked shirt without a tie, a patched green cardigan, and grey trousers scuffed and stained. One trouser leg was missing. It had been folded over and sewn shut just below the torso. Something about his appearance disconcerted her. It took her a moment to realize she had never seen a magician so informally dressed.
"I was simply trying to get hold of a volume of Gibbon," Mr. Button was saying, "which I spied at the bottom of a pile. I was careless and lost my balance. There was such a landslide. You cannot imagine how taxing it is to find anything in this place."
Kitty looked around. Across the room, innumerable stacks of books rose like stalagmites from the ancient carpet. Many of these columns were as tall as her. Others had half capsized against each other, forming precarious arches swathed in dust. Books rested high upon a table and filled the cupboards of a dresser. They receded in unguessed-at numbers through an open door and deep into a side room. A few narrow walkways remained clear, connecting the windows with two sofas squeezed before a fireplace and the exit to the hall. "I think I've got some idea," she said. "Anyway, here's something to add to your problem." She picked up her package. "From Hernex." The old man's eyes sparkled.
"Good, good. That would be my edition of Ptolemy's Apocrypha, newly bound in calfhide. Carol Hernex is a marvel. My dear, you have improved my day twice over. I insist you stay for tea."
Within half an hour, Kitty had learned three things. That the old gentleman was garrulous and affable, that he possessed a fine supply of tea and spice cake, and that his need for an assistant was greatly pressing.
"My last helper left me a fortnight ago," he said, sighing heavily. "Joined up to fight for Britain. I tried to talk him out of it, of course, but his heart was set on going. He believed what he was told. Glory, good prospects, promotion, all that. He'll be dead soon, I expect. Yes, do have that last piece of cake, dear. You need feeding up. It's all very well for him going off to die, but I fear my studies have been severely restricted."
"What studies are those, sir?"
Kitty asked.
"Researches, dear. History of magic and other things. A fascinating area, sadly neglected. It's a crying shame that so many libraries are being closed. Once again, the government is acting out of fear. Well, I've saved a good many important books on the subject, and I wish to catalogue and index them. It is my ambition to prepare a definitive list of all surviving djinn. Existing records are so haphazard and contradictory. But as you have seen, I am not even dexterous enough to research my own collection, thanks to this impediment.
He shook a fist at his non-existent leg.
How did it happen, sir?
Kitty ventured, if you don't mind my asking.
My leg?
The old gentleman lowered his brows, glanced left and right, and looked up at Kitty. He spoke in a sinister whisper.
Married.
A married? But aren't they the most...
The most powerful type of commonly summoned demon. Correct.
Mr. Button's smile was slightly smug.
I'm no slouch, my dear. Not that any of my colleagues, he spoke the word with vehement distaste, would admit as much, blast them. I'd like to see Rupert Devereux and Carl Mortensen do as well.
He sniffed, settled back into his sofa.
The irony of it was that I just wanted to ask it a few questions. Wasn't going to enslave it at all. Anyway, I'd forgotten to add a tertiary fettering. The thing broke out and had my leg off before the automatic dismissal set in.
He shook his head.
That's the penalty of curiosity, my dear. Well, I get by somehow. I'll find another assistant if the Americans don't kill our entire population of young males.
He took a tetchy bite of his spice cake. Even before he had swallowed, Kitty had made up her mind.
I'll help you out, sir.
The old magician blinked at her.
You?
Yes, sir. I'll be your assistant.
I'm sorry, my dear, but I thought you worked for Hernex.
Oh, I do, sir, but only temporarily. I'm looking for other work. I'm very interested in books and magic, sir. Really, I am. I've always wanted to learn about it.
Indeed. Do you speak Hebrew?
No, sir.
Or Czech, or French, or Arabic?
No, none of those, sir.
Indeed.
For a moment, Mr. Button's face became less amiable, less courteous. He looked at her sidelong out of half-shut eyes.
And the fact of the matter is, of course, that you are nothing but a commoner's girl.
Kitty nodded brightly.
Yes, sir, but I've always believed that misfortunes of birth shouldn't stand in the way of talent. I'm energetic and quick, and nimble, too.
She gestured around the maze of dusty piles.
I'll be able to get hold of any book you like, fast as thinking, from the bottom of the farthest stack.
She grinned and took a sip of tea. The old man was rubbing his chin with small, plump fingers, muttering to himself,
A commoner's child, unvetted. It is highly unorthodox. In fact, the authorities expressly forbid it. But, well, after all, why not?
He tittered to himself.
Why shouldn't I? They've seen fit to neglect me all these years. It would be an interesting experiment, and they'd never know, blast them.
He looked at Kitty again, eyes narrowed.
You know, I couldn't pay you anything.
That's all right, sir. I'm, interested in knowledge for its own sake. I'll get other work. I could help you out whenever you needed it, part-time.
Very well, then. Very well.
Mr. Button extended a small pink hand.
We shall see how it works out. Neither of us has any contractual obligation to the other, you understand, and we are free to terminate the relationship at any time. Mind, if you are lazy or dishonest, I shall raise a hauler to shrivel you. But goodness, where are my manners? I've not yet asked your name.
Kitty selected an identity.
Lizzie Temple, sir.
Well, Lizzie, very glad to have met you. I hope we shall get along well.
And so they had. From the beginning, Kitty made herself indispensable to Mr. Button. To start with, her chores were entirely concerned with navigating her way about his dark and cluttered house, accessing obscure books in distant stacks, and bringing them out to him unscathed. This was easier said than done. She frequently emerged into the lamplight of the magician's study, wheezing and covered in dust, or bruised by a nasty bookful, only to be told she had the wrong volume or an incorrect edition, and be sent back to begin again. But Kitty stuck with it. Gradually she became adept at locating the volumes Mr. Button required. She began to recognize the names, the covers, the methods of binding employed by different printers in different cities across the centuries. For his part, the magician was highly satisfied. His helper spared him much inconvenience. So the months passed. Kitty took to asking brief questions about some of the works she helped locate. Sometimes Mr. Button gave succinct and breezy answers. More often he suggested she look up the solution herself. When the book was written in English, this Kitty was able to do. She borrowed some of the easier, more general volumes and took them home to her bedsit. Her nocturnal readings prompted further questions to Mr. Button, who directed her to other texts. In this way, directed by caprice and whimsical inclination, Kitty began to learn. After a year of such progress, Kitty began going on errands for the magician. She procured official passes and visited libraries across the capital. She made occasional forays to herbalists and to suppliers of magical goods. Mr. Button had no imps at his service and did not practice much actual magic. His interest lay in the cultures of the past and the history of contact with demons. Occasionally he summoned a minor entity to question it on a particular historical point.
"But it's a difficult business with one leg," he told Kitty. "Summoning's bad enough with two of them, but when you're trying to draw the circle straight and your stick's slipping and you keep dropping the chalk, it's hellish tricky. I don't risk it often any more."
"I could give you a hand, sir," Kitty suggested. "You'd have to teach me the basics, of course."
"Oh, that would be impossible. Far too dangerous for us both."
Kitty found Mr. Button quite adamant on this, and it took her several months of pestering to win him over. Finally, to gain a moment's peace, he allowed her to fill the bowls with incense, hold the pin in position while he inscribed the circle's arcs, and light the pig's fat candles. She stood behind his chair when the demon appeared and was questioned. Afterward, she helped douse the scorch marks left behind. Her calm demeanour impressed the magician. Soon she was actively assisting in all his summonings. As in all things, Kitty learned swiftly. She began to memorize some of the common Latin formulae, although she remained ignorant of the language. Mr. Button, who found active work taxing on his health, and who was also inclined to laziness, began to entrust his assistant with more and more procedures. In his cursory way, he helped fill in some of the gaps in her knowledge, although he refused to instruct her formally.
"The actual craft," he would say, "is simplicity itself. But it has infinite variations. We shall always keep to basics. Summon the creature, keep it constrained, send it off again. I have neither the time nor the inclination to teach you all the subtleties."
"That's fine, sir," Kitty said.
She had neither the time nor the inclination to learn them. A basic practical knowledge of summoning was all that she required. The years passed. The war dragged on. Mr. Button's books were neatly sorted, catalogued, and stacked by author. His assistant was invaluable to him. Now he could direct her to summon foliates and even minor djinn while he sat in comfort watching. It was a highly satisfactory arrangement. And, barring the odd fright, Kitty found it satisfactory too. With the kettle boiled at last, Kitty made the tea and returned to the magician, who was sitting, as before, in the sofa's depths, studying his book. Mr. Button gave a grunt of thanks as she set the teapot down.
"Trismegistus notes," he said, "that succubi tend to recklessness when summoned, and are often impelled to self-destruction. They can be placated by placing citrus fruits among the incense, or by the soft playing of panpipes. They are sensual beasts, evidently."
He scratched his stump absently through his trousers.
"Oh, I found something else, too, Lizzie. What was that demon you were asking about the other day?"
"Bartimaeus, sir."
"Yes, that's it. Trismegistus has a reference to him in one of his tables of antique gin. Somewhere in the appendices, you'll find."
"Oh, really, sir? That's great. Thank you."
"Give us a little of his summoning history. Brief. You won't find it terribly interesting."
"No, sir. I very much doubt it."
She held out a hand.
"Do you mind if I take a look?"
Part 2. Alexandria, 126 BC. Bartimaeus. On a hot morning in midsummer, a sacred bull broke free of its compound beside the river. It rampaged up among the fields, biting at flies and swinging its horns at anything that moved. Three men who tried to secure it were badly injured. The bull plunged on among the reeds and broke out onto a path where children played. As they screamed and scattered, it paused as if in doubt. But the sun upon the water and the whiteness of the children's clothes enraged it. Head down, it charged upon the nearest girl, and would have gored or trampled her to death, had not Ptolemy and I been strolling down that way. The prince raised a hand. I acted. The bull stopped mid-charge, as if it had collided with a wall. Head reeling, eyes crossed, it capsized into the dust, where it remained until attendants secured it with ropes and led it back into its field. Ptolemy waited while his aides calmed the children, then resumed his constitutional. He did not refer to the incident again. Even so, by the time we returned to the palace, a flock of rumours had taken flight and was swooping and swirling about his head. By nightfall, everyone in the city, from the lowest beggar to the snootiest priest of Ra, had heard or misheard something of it. As was my wont, I had wandered late among the evening markets, listening to the rhythms of the city, to the ebb and flow of information carried on its human tide. My master was sitting cross-legged on the roof of his quarters, intermittently scratching at his papyrus strip, and gazing out toward the darkened sea. I landed on the ledge in Lapwing's form, and fixed him with a beady eye. "It's all over the bazaars," I said. "You and the bull?" He dipped his stylus into the ink. "What matter?" "Perhaps no matter, perhaps much. But the people whisper."
"What do they whisper?"
"That you are a sorcerer who consorts with demons." He laughed and completed a neat numeral.
"Factually, they are correct."
The Lapwing drummed his claws upon the stone. "I protest. The term demon is fallacious and abusive in the extreme." Note my restraint here. My standard of conversation was pretty high in those days, on account of conversing with Ptolemy. Something about him made you disinclined to be too vulgar, blasphemous, or impudent, and even made me rein in my use of estuary Egyptian slang. It wasn't that he forbade any of it, more that you ended up feeling a bit guilty, as if you'd let yourself down. Harsh invective was a no-no, too. It's surprising I had anything left to say. Ptolemy put down his stylus. "It is a mistake to be too concerned with names and titles, my dear Reckitt. Such things are never more than rough approximations, matters of convenience. The people speak thus out of ignorance. It's when they understand your nature and are still abusive that you will have to worry." He grinned at me sidelong. "Which is always possible, let's face it." I raised my wings a little, allowing the sea wind to ruffle through my feathers. "Generally, you come off well in the account so far. But mark my words, they'll be saying you let the bull loose soon." He sighed. "In all honesty, reputation, for good or ill, doesn't much bother me." "It may not bother you," I said darkly, "but there are those in the palace for whom the issue is life and death." "Only those who drown in the stew of politics," he said, "and I'm nothing to them." "May it be so," I said darkly. "May it be so. What are you writing now?"
"Your description of the elemental walls at the margins of the world. So take that scowl off your beak and tell me more of it."
Well, I let it go at that. Arguing with Ptolemy never did much good.
From the beginning he was a master of curious enthusiasms. The accumulation of wealth, wives, and bijou Nile-front properties, those time-honoured preoccupations of most Egyptian magicians, did not enthrall him. Knowledge of a kind was what he was after, but it was not the sort that turns city walls to dust and tramples on the necks of the defeated foe. It had a more otherworldly cast. In our first encounter he threw me with it. I was a pillar of whirling sand, a fashionable get-up in those days. My voice boomed like rockfalls echoing up a gully.
"Name your desire, mortal."
"Jinni," he said. "Answer me a question." The sand whirled faster.
I know the secrets of the earth and the mysteries of the air. I know the key to the minds of women.
Patently all lies, especially the last bit.
What do you wish? Speak.
What is essence?
The sand halted in mid-air.
Eh?
Your substance. What exactly is it? How does it work?
Well,
And the other place. Tell me of it. Is time there synchronous with ours? What form do its denizens take? Have they a king or leader? Is it a dimension of solid substance, or a whirling inferno, or otherwise? What are the boundaries between your realm and this earth, and to what degree are they permeable?
In short, Ptolemy was interested in us. Jinn. His slaves. Our inner nature, that is, not the usual surface guff. The most hideous shapes and provocations made him yawn, while my attempts to mock his youth and girlish looks merely elicited hearty chuckles. He would sit in the centre of his pentacle, stylus on his knee, listening with rapt attention, ticking me off when I introduced a more than usually obvious fib, and frequently interrupting to clarify some ambiguity. He used no stipples, no lances, no other instruments of correction. His summonings rarely lasted more than a few hours. To a hardened jinni like me, who had a fairly accurate idea of the vicious ways of humans, it was all a bit disconcerting. I was one of a number of jinn and lesser spirits regularly summoned. The normal routine never deviated. Summons, chat, frenzied scribbling by the magician, dismissal. In time, my curiosity was aroused. "Why do you do this?" I asked him curtly. "Why all these questions, all this writing?"
"I have read most of the manuscripts in the Great Library," the boy said. "They have much about summoning, chastisement, and other practicalities, but almost nothing about the nature of demons themselves. Your personality, your own desires, it seems to me that this is of the first importance. I intend to write the definitive work on the subject, a book that will be read and admired for ever. To do this, I must ask many questions. Does my ambition surprise you?"
"Yes, in truth. Since when has any magician cared about our sufferings? There's no reason why you should. It's not in your interests."
"Oh, but it is. If we remain ignorant and continue to enslave you rather than understand you, trouble will come from it sooner or later. That's my feeling."
"There is no alternative to this slavery. Each summons wraps us in chains."
"You are too pessimistic, Jinni. Traders tell me of shamans far off among the northern wastes who leave their own bodies to converse with spirits in another world. To my mind, that is a much more courteous proceeding. Perhaps we too should learn this technique."
I laughed harshly. "It will never happen. That route is far too perilous for the corn-fed priests of Egypt. Save your energy, boy. Forget your futile questions. Dismiss me and have done."
Despite my skepticism, he could not be dissuaded. A year went by. Little by little, my lies dried up. I began to tell him truth. In turn, he told me something of himself. He was a nephew of the king. At birth, 12 years before, he had been a frail and delicate runtling, coughing at the nipple, squealing like a kitten. His discomfort cast a pall over the ceremony of naming. The guests departed hurriedly. The silent officials exchanged somber looks. At midnight, his wet nurse summoned a priest of Hathor, who pronounced the infant close to death. Nevertheless, he completed the necessary rituals and gave the child into the protection of the goddess. Hathor, divine mother and protector of the newborn. Jinn in her temples wore female guises with the heads of cattle. The night passed fitfully. Dawn came. The first rays of sun glimmered through the acacia trees and fell upon the infant's head. His squalling subsided. His body grew calm. Without noise or hesitation, he nuzzled at the breast and drank. The nature of this reprieve did not go unnoticed, and the child was swiftly dedicated to the sun god Ra. He grew steadily in strength and years. Quick-eyed and intelligent, he was never as strapping as his cousin, the king's son, 8 years older and burly with it. He was a Ptolemy, too. As they all were, these kings of Egypt, for 200 years and more, one after the other, until Cleopatra spoiled the run. Originality was not the family's strong suit. Easy to see, perhaps, why my Ptolemy regarded names so casually. They meant little. He told me his the first time I asked him. Ptolemy remained a peripheral figure in the court, happier with the priests and women than with the sun-browned boys brawling in the yard. In those days the king was frequently on campaign, struggling to protect the frontiers against the incursions of the Bedouin. A series of advisers ruled the city, growing rich on bribes and port taxes, and listening ever closer to the soft words of foreign agents, particularly those of the emerging power across the water, Rome. Swathed in luxury in his marbled palace, the king's son fell into precocious dissipation. By his late teens he was a grotesque, loose-lipped youth, already pot-bellied with drink. His eyes glittered with paranoia and the fear of assassination. Impatient for power, he dawdled in the shadow of his father, seeking rivals in his blood-kin while waiting for the old man to die. Ptolemy, by contrast, was a scholarly boy, slim and handsome, with features more nearly Egyptian than Greek. They came from his mother's side, I guess. She was a native girl from upriver somewhere, a concubine in the royal apartments. I never saw her. She and his father died of plague before my time. Though distantly in line for the throne, he was clearly not a warrior or a statesman, and was generally ignored by the royal household. He spent most of his time in the library of Alexandria, close to the waterfront, studying with his tutor. This man, an elderly priest from Luxor, was learned in many languages and in the history of the kingdom. He was also a magician. Finding an exceptional student, he imparted his knowledge to the child. It was quietly begun and quietly completed, and only much later, with the incident of the bull, did rumour of it seep out into the wider world. 2 days afterward, while we were in discussion, a servant knocked upon my master's door.
"Pardon me, Highness, but a woman waits without."
"Without what?" I wore the guise of a scholar in case of just such an interruption. Ptolemy silenced me with a gesture.
"What does she want?" "A plague of locusts threatens her husband's crop, sir. She seeks your aid."
My master frowned.
"Ridiculous. What can I do?"
"Sir, she speaks of—"
The servant hesitated. He had been with us in the field.
"Of your power over the bull."
"This is too much. I am hard at work here. I cannot be disturbed. Send her away."
"As you wish."
The servant sighed, made to close the door. My master stirred.
"Is she very miserable?"
"Mightily, sir. She has been here since dawn."
Ptolemy gave a gasp of impatience.
"Oh, this is rank foolishness."
He turned to me.
"Reckitt, go with him, see what can be done."
In due course I returned, looking plump. "Locust's gone."
"Very well."
He scowled at his tablets.
"I have altogether lost the thread. We were talking about the fluidity of the other place, I believe."
"You realize," I said as I sat delicately on the straw matting, "that you've done it now. Got yourself a reputation. Someone who can solve the common ills. Now you'll never get any peace. Same thing happened to Solomon with the wisdom thing. Couldn't step outdoors without someone thrusting a baby in his face. Mind you, that was often for a different reason." The boy shook his head.
"I am a scholar, a researcher, nothing else. I shall aid mankind by the fruits of my writing, not by my success with bulls or locusts. Besides, it's you who's doing the work, Reckitt. Do you mind removing that wing case from the corner of your mouth?"
"Thank you."
"Now, to begin."
He was wise about some things, Ptolemy was, but not about others. The next day saw two more women standing outside his chambers. One had problems with hippos on her land, the other carried a sick child. Once again I was sent to deal with them as best I could. On the morning after that, a little line of people stretched out into the street. My master tore his hair and lamented his ill fortune. Nevertheless, I was dispatched again, along with Afa and Penrhynutet, two of his other djinn. So it went. Progress on his research slowed to a snail's pace, while his reputation among the ordinary people of Alexandria grew fast as summer's flowering. Ptolemy suffered the interruption.